Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the May 9th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing today, we have President Donald Trump sitting at a desk. He is holding a report card in front of him. It says, "To Donald Trump from the American people, grading period 100 days, and the grades are economy D, tariffs D minus, border security A, rule of law D minus, foreign policy D, deportations D, free speech D, for a grade average of D." And I believe, the headline is Getting Results. America delivers its verdict on Trump's first 100 days. That is a Talking Points article. We'll see if we catch that, but we're going to start with the second main story today. Deportations ensnare migrant families, U.S. citizens. What happened? The Trump administration ramped up its deportation campaign this week, defending recent expulsions of American children, along with their immigrant parents, and arresting a Milwaukee judge accused of obstructing a migrant's arrest. In two separate incidents in Louisiana, women checking in for routine immigration appointments with ICE were arrested and deported to Honduras, along with their American citizen children. One of the three children deported, a four-year-old boy, had been undergoing cancer treatment. Lawyers for both families said the mothers weren't given the option to leave their children with relatives in the U.S. There is a strong suspicion that the government just deported a U.S. citizen with no meaningful process, said Louisiana Federal District Court Judge Terry A. Daugherty, a Trump appointee handling one of the cases. Other deportations separated children from their parents. Tampa resident Heidi Sanchez said she was forced to leave her unweaned baby behind when she was deported to Cuba, while a two-year-old girl in Texas was sent to foster care after her mother was deported to Venezuela and her father to El Salvador's CICOT prison. In Wisconsin, a Milwaukee County judge, Hannah Dugan, was cuffed and charged with obstructing federal officers after allegedly directing an immigrant, a defendant in a domestic violence case, to an exit so he could avoid ICE agents. In Maryland, federal judge Paula Zenas demanded the Trump administration provide an update in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran who was mistakenly sent to CICOT. The administration has argued it can't get him back, but President Trump told ABC News this week that, in fact, he could do so, but will not, saying falsely that Abrego Garcia had MS-13, a gang name, tattooed across his knuckles. What the editorial said. Democrats are seeking to portray the arrest of the Milwaukee judge as part of a Trump administration campaign against the judiciary, said the Wall Street Journal. But ICE agents had a lawful order to detain her defendant, who is here illegally. Rather than comply with ICE, Dugan actually canceled the man's hearing, denying his alleged victims their day in court. Dugan is free to disagree with the administration's immigration policies, but she can't obstruct federal officers seeking to enforce the law. The administration is deporting with such zeal it's becoming apparent that citizens are being imperiled, said the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Secretary of State Marco Rubio clarified that the American citizen children from Louisiana who were deported may return to the care of a relative who is a citizen. But why the haste to deport in the first place? These local moms may have been present illegally, but they weren't criminals. It appears disturbingly as if Louisiana residents face increased risk of being ensnared in ICE actions merely because the federal detention centers are located here. What the columnist said. Just why are so many migrants sent to Louisiana anyway? Asked Layla Loss and Mary Yannick in the New York Times. The reason ICE has 9 centers there, including a giant 7,000-bed staging area, is because the state is notorious for conservative courts, scarce access to legal support, and horrific detention conditions. It's effectively a black hole where migrants can be mistreated and denied their rights. This situation threatens to erode America's rule of law well beyond the immigration legal system. But a backlash is brewing, said Patricia Lopez in Bloomberg. Americans expected deportation of the people they'd been told were stealing jobs and committing crimes, not nursing mothers. Instead, the administration is targeting non-criminals and even legal immigrants with green cards who protested against Israel. Skipping an immigration check-in means ICE can hunt you down and arrest you. Cooperating now yields the same result. It doesn't seem fair. No wonder a majority of voters now disapprove of Trump's handling of deportations. Still, Dugan's arrest suggests the White House won't temper the crackdown, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. One need not approve of Dugan's alleged conduct here to understand that the White House is trying to intimidate judges who so far have not been easily cowed into doing its bidding. Even activists are being arrested, said Marcella Garcia in the Boston Globe. In Virginia last week, 2 volunteer immigrant advocates merely asked ICE to show a warrant. They are now being threatened with obstruction charges. It's chillingly clear. Judges, lawyers, and ordinary citizens are now potential targets if they dare to interfere with ICE. Controversy of the week. Musk. What did he accomplish with Doge? Only 2 months ago, the world's richest person seemed unstoppable, said David Smith in The Guardian. Now Elon Musk is hanging up his chainsaw. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles confirmed this week that the billionaire is not physically present as much as he was during his first months leading President Trump's Department of Government Efficiency. And the Tesla CEO recently announced that he'll spend less time on Doge as he refocuses on rescuing his car company, which saw profits plunge 71% in the first quarter amid a backlash over his gleeful assault on government. But even harder to undo will be the devastating human toll of Doge. The project fired or forced out more than 260,000 federal workers, deleted humanitarian aid for millions of desperate people overseas, and scrapped more than $2 billion in biomedical research grants. And for what? Asked Zeeshan Aleem in MSNBC.com. Musk originally promised he'd save taxpayers $2 trillion, a total he's since lowered to $150 billion. But even if his numbers are correct, which they frequently aren't, research suggests those savings will be outweighed by the cost of Doge-related firings, rehirings, and court battles, and by a substantial drop in tax collection from a shrunken IRS. Whatever one thought of Musk's cost-cutting crusade at its onset, surely no one wanted this result. A worse government at roughly the same cost. For anyone hoping Musk would single-handedly erase the extra $2.5 trillion added to the deficit by the Biden administration, Doge has been a massive letdown, said Christian Britschke in Reason. But compared with the unchecked spending likely under President Kamala Harris, Doge was a smashing success, fulfilling its pledge to shrink the federal workforce and reduce regulatory sprawl. I don't blame Musk one bit for stepping back, said Ingrid Jacques in USA Today. As leftists vandalize Cybertrucks and firebomb Tesla dealerships, with hardly a peep of condemnation from elected Democrats, it may be the only way Musk can save his company. The rest of us should thank him, not hate him, for trying to save America from fiscal ruin. Musk tried nothing of the sort, said Jessica Rydell in the New York Post. The federal budget is indeed full of waste, from overlapping education programs to over-budget defense procurements, but Musk had no appetite for the quiet, boring work of deficit reduction. He pursued vendettas against foreign aid, staffers, Politico subscriptions, and similar high-profile culture war targets, rather than dig into Social Security and other mandatory programs that consume three-quarters of federal spending. Musk baby-faced operatives did succeed in grabbing troves of America's personal data from multiple government agencies, said Julia Angwin in the New York Times. That information is now being merged at the Department of Homeland Security into a sprawling domestic surveillance system, the likes of which we have never seen in the U.S. DOGE no longer needs its turbulent creator, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Its employees are now routinely embedded in federal agencies, and leadership of the assault on the federal bureaucracy is expected to pass to Russell Vought, director of Trump's Office of Management and Budget. The Project 2025 co-author and self-declared Christian nationalist shares Musk's loathing of the deep state, but will be cannier and more methodical in effecting its destruction. The soft-spoken Vault will never match Musk's cartoon villain malevolence, but his dull knife will cut even deeper than Musk's chainsaw, and a lot less noisily. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for relapsing after Gwyneth Paltrow confessed on her Goop podcast that she has grown a little sick of her restrictive paleo diet and has started eating cheese and carbohydrates again. There, I said it, added the 52-year-old actress and wellness tycoon. It's a good week for aspiring warfighters after the U.S. Army announced that its fitness test will no longer grade soldiers on how far they can fling a 10-pound medicine ball backward over their heads. The so-called ball yeet became notorious over the years for favoring taller personnel and for testing a skill with limited combat application. It was a good week for reunions after a British man bought a used Honda Civic to replace one stolen in February and found that its trunk had a familiar smell of stale beer, and that his home address was already in its GPS. It was pretty clear at this point that it was my car, said Ewan Valentine, 36. But it was a bad week for never forgetting. After Navy Secretary John Phelan visited Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and posted two tributes to the U.S. civilians and service members killed on the fateful day of June 7, 1941. In fact, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor took place on December 7, 1941, what then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt called a date that will live in infamy. It was a bad week for interactive art after a young child visiting a Dutch museum waved a hand and accidentally left several scratch marks on gray, orange, on maroon number 8, a $50 million Mark Rothko painting. The work has since been removed from display and sent for restoration. Finally, it was a bad week for raising the roof after a ceiling panel on a Delta flight from Atlanta to Chicago collapsed during takeoff, forcing passengers to hold it up by hand for about 45 minutes. Passenger Thomas Witchie said attendants eventually scotch-taped the panel back into position. The briefing topic this week is the Alien Enemies Act. President Trump is using a long-dormant law to deport Venezuelans. How does it work? What is the Alien Enemies Act? It's an 18th century law that allows the president to detain or deport immigrants from countries the U.S. is at war with. In more than 225 years, the law has been invoked just three times, always during major conflicts that had been declared wars by Congress, until President Trump triggered it in March against the Venezuelan criminal gang Tren de Aragua. He said the gang, which has spread across the Americas as millions of migrants fled Venezuela in recent years, was perpetrating, attempting, and threatening an invasion or predatory incursion on U.S. soil. Trump has used his authority under the law to deport more than 200 men to a prison camp in El Salvador, but he's facing pushback in the courts as legal scholars argue that the act doesn't apply in the current situation. We haven't had a declared war, said Georgetown University law professor Steve Vladek, and no one has tried to argue that the invasion or predatory incursion language could be used in any context other than a conventional war. What powers does it grant? The act allows the president to detain and deport, without hearing, any immigrant from an enemy nation during wartime. No evidence of disloyalty or criminal behavior is necessary. Along with the Naturalization Act, the Sedition Act, and the Alien Friends Act, it made up the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which President John Adams signed into law at a time when the U.S. faced the prospect of war with France. Whenever there shall be a declared war, or any invasion or predatory incursion shall be perpetrated, attempted, or threatened against the U.S., it says, all subjects of the hostile nation or government can be apprehended, restrained, secured, and removed as alien enemies. Why was it created? The point was ostensibly to root out foreign spies and saboteurs. But the Alien and Sedition Acts were also a way for Adams' Federalist Party to target the immigrants who largely supported the opposition Democratic-Republican Party. Many lawmakers denounced the laws as unconstitutional and Adams himself as a tyrant, to the point where Abigail Adams feared for her husband's safety. When Thomas Jefferson succeeded Adams in 1801, he repealed the other three parts of the Alien and Sedition Acts or let them expire. But the Alien Enemies Acts remained on the books. Historian Joseph Ellis called support for the Alien Enemies Act unquestionably the biggest blunder of Adams' presidency. When has it been invoked? President James Madison first used it during the War of 1812 to require all British nationals in the U.S. to register with the government, reporting personal information such as age, address, and whether they'd applied for citizenship. It wasn't until a century later, during World War I, that President Woodrow Wilson used it against German-born male residents, registering 480,000 men and detaining over 6,000. It was last used by President Franklin D. Roosevelt during World War II to intern thousands of Germans and Italians in camps. Most of the 100,000 Japanese Americans interned were held under a different legal basis. None of these events, though, involved large-scale deportations. Is its use constitutional? Yes, during wartime. The Alien Enemies Act first reached the Supreme Court in 1948. In Ludecky v. Watkins, the court rejected an appeal by a German immigrant who'd been ordered to leave the U.S. in 1946. At issue was whether the war had ended by then, which would have meant the law was no longer applicable. Divided on the subject, the court concluded that the definition of wartime was too political for it to answer, and it upheld the deportation. Having survived this legal challenge, the act was largely ignored by the courts and Congress for decades. Yet four justices joined in a key dissent in that 1948 case, arguing that the act denied immigrants due process and constituted an effort to suppress political speech. The notion that the discretion of any officer of government can override due process is foreign to our system, wrote Justice William Douglas. Due process does not perish when war comes. How does Trump justify its use? Trump has repeatedly referred to migration to the U.S., particularly from Latin America, as an invasion, and maintains that the Tren de Aragua gang constitutes an invading army. When asked whether he was in violation of a district judge's order to halt the deportations of Venezuelans to El Salvador, Trump said, "This is a time of war." But only Congress can declare a war, and so far the Supreme Court has limited the deportations without ruling on whether Trump may invoke the act. What has the court said? The Supreme Court ruled unanimously on April 7th that any person in the U.S., even an alien enemy, has the right to fight their deportation in court. 2 weeks later, it issued a rare late-night order pausing deportations of a group of Venezuelans. Now it is up to each individual migrant to plead their case to a judge. But most legal scholars agree that the administration has overreached and the court should do more. Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemies Act than has happened here, said U.S. Circuit Judge Patricia Millett. Moving into some of the best columns of the week, we'll start with the anti-woke right's hypocrisy. The anti-woke right never really cared about free speech, said David French. The coalition of podcasters, influencers, and tech moguls rocketed to mainstream prominence in 2020 with a simple message. Cancel culture was real. And Americans need not mindlessly obey government dictates like COVID restrictions. But as the anti-woke right allied itself with Republican politicians, the movement was divided between a love for liberty and a hatred for the left. Hatred won. In its quest for control, the movement backed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as he launched a censorious culture war in his state, sharply limiting any discussion of sexuality and racism in schools, and punishing Disney when it dared criticize his policies. In 2024, most of the free thinkers of the anti-woke right backed Donald Trump, the most speech-restrictive authoritarian president in more than a century. Trump has used federal power to punish law firms and universities for their views, ban words like diversity, and censor divisive ideas about America's radical history. The supposed champion of liberty have been largely silent or even cheered Trump on. Clearly, they believe free speech is important only so long as they get to say what they think. Betraying Afghan refugees. The Trump administration has begun laying the groundwork for a possible mass deportation of nearly 90,000 Afghans living in the U.S., said Will Selber. If these refugees are sent back to the Taliban, it will be a death sentence. The Department of Homeland Security recently sent emails to Afghan refugees telling them to self-deport. These are people who fled the country when its government fell and were welcomed here under Biden administration programs. As an Afghanistan veteran, I knew many of these people as friends and allies of the U.S. war effort, and we owe them a safe place to live after we abandoned their country to brutal medieval extremists. The Taliban have brought back all of their greatest hits, public executions, floggings, and government-sponsored sexual assaults. Afghans who fled will be prime targets for torture and death if they return. America's military community will be heartsick if Afghans we shed blood to protect are sent back to hellish fates. It will complete America's betrayal of not only its Afghan combat veterans, their families, and millions of Afghan women and children, but our nation's deepest values. So much for making America great. This column comes from Mexico. end the myth of the noble gang member. Mexicans live in terror of cartel violence, mourning the murdered and the disappeared. So why do we still listen to ballads that glorify the executioners, asked Saul Arellano. While search groups scour deserts and wilderness in search of human remains, millions of people at parties, concerts, and on social media euphorically sing so-called narcocorridos. These songs celebrate the exploits of drug lords and hitmen, men who kill without guilt or remorse, who treat women as ornaments, objects of consumption, or trophies. Narcocorridos don't just describe these men, they mythologize them. The hired assassin is portrayed not as a ruthless killer, but a brave man, while the gang boss is lionized as a rebel who stands up to the state and shows loyalty to his men. As we sing along, we find ourselves admiring these criminals without thinking about the horror they've wreaked on our society. It's a kind of widespread cultural anesthesia, and it's harming us. That's why, finally, some cities have begun banning performances of narcocorridos, and some artists are refusing to sing them. Silencing this poison isn't censorship. It's necessary to heal our culture. Maybe we can start singing songs where the hero isn't the one who kills, but the one who cares. And this column comes from Sweden. Mesmerized by the moose migration. It's time once again for Swedes to slow down and watch the moose go by, said Olof Jonmyren. Our public broadcaster is live streaming the annual Great Moose Migration 24 hours a day on its website, svtplay.se. Millions of Swedes are tuning in to witness the massive animals trekking through forest and swimming across lakes on the annual journey from their protected winter grounds to summer breeding grounds near the coast. The images are constantly changing, cutting among 34 cameras set up along the route. But there's no music or voiceover, just nature's sound loop. It's a welcome relief from the stress of everyday life. Most of the time, pace is everything in our modern world. We're expected to do more, get things done, be hyper-efficient. But when you are watching the moose plod along in real time, no one wants to sell you stuff you didn't ask for. No one plots against anyone else. No one screams. And yet you don't want to miss a moment. The most dramatic leg of the journey comes when the moose reach the Angermann River and must choose where to ford it. If you step away, you might return to find your favorite moose at the water's edge has left and swam across. Even in this unhurried world, there are moments that swoop by. How to Survive a Purge is the title of The Last Word, our feature article. Lawyers at the Department of Justice are trying to keep their heads down, wrote an anonymous DOJ staffer in a diary published in The Economist. But how much compromise is too much? A couple of years ago, I began displaying some memorabilia in my office. Press clippings, photos, a gold coin with the Department of Justice's insignia on one side, and an image of the Capitol building on the other. They commemorated cases I had prosecuted against those who took part in the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. When Donald Trump was reelected last November, a colleague asked if I was going to take them down. Hell no, I said. What was the new administration going to do? Call me out for upholding my oath to defend the Constitution? I wasn't going to hide work I was proud of. In the days that followed, I reconsidered. Trump started off his term by pardoning every last January 6th defendant, then went after the people who put them in jail. Within the first 2 weeks of his administration, the Justice Department had axed dozens of prosecutors associated with the January 6th investigations. I'd expected some people to go. Every new administration makes staff changes. But this was nothing short of a purge. It targeted some of the best and brightest, people who had sacrificed their evenings and weekends to the job because they wanted to preserve democracy. Not long after the sacking started, I grabbed coffee with a colleague. We decided to meet farther away from the office than usual to avoid being overheard. We greeted each other with a rueful hug. We survived the first cull. We're like cockroaches looking for the next couch to hide under, I joked. We talked about resigning, something neither of us wanted to do. We decided the best course of action in the short term was to keep our heads down and do our job. As we drained our coffees, my colleague suggested that we use an end-to-end encrypted app to communicate. Who knew what this administration would use against us? It seemed absurd to take such a precaution in America, but he was probably right. I returned to my office and settled into my chair. The January 6th memorabilia caught my eye. Before the purge, I'd been in a defiant mood, but my calculus had changed. If the president's supporters saw these items, I could get fired. It was hardly keeping my head down. I called an old friend whose judgment I trust and asked her what she thought. She told me to take them down. Better to make this small compromise now, if it means you can stay for decisions in the matter. I carefully placed the mementos in a box and put it inside my desk drawer. It was the sensible thing to do, but part of me felt like a coward. As time went on, a chill descended on the department. The hallways used to be a hubbub of chatter about cases, family life, weekend plans, but then they grew quiet. Conversations moved behind closed doors, and we became furtive and reticent. People cried in meetings. I often wondered why I still had a job. About 6 weeks into the administration, I got a late-night phone call from my mentor. Over his long career, he has developed a knack for navigating the politics of the job and has always looked out for me. Normally, we'd have a meandering chat, but this time he had a blunt message. Be careful. There are a lot of tripwires out there, he said. In a weird way, I found this reassuring. At least I wasn't being paranoid. Shortly afterward, I saw what he meant about tripwires. Pam Bondi, Trump's new attorney general, announced plans to root out those in the Justice Department who despise Trump and don't want to be there. She formed a working group to investigate, among other things, the unethical prosecutions that arose from the January 6 investigations. You could tell which lawyers are Bondi's people by the obsequiousness with which they praise the president. They are her eyes and ears within the department. Some are experienced lawyers who conduct themselves like professionals. Others, not so much. I'm dying inside, said one colleague who now has to work alongside a MAGA true believer. I could hear the strain in her voice. The Trump loyalist has tried to get her to do things that don't feel right, she said. She didn't go into details, and I didn't probe, but I believed her. The administration clearly sees the Justice Department as an instrument for expanding presidential power to the fullest extent. On February 18th, Trump issued an executive order in which he essentially said that the law is what the president and the attorney general say it is, not the courts. I fear that means we will be instructed to obey orders that are clearly unlawful. Some employees are opting to leave. A few don't like the atmosphere. Others, like the lawyers directed to dismiss the corruption case against Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, resign on principle. Most of us seem to be staying, at least for now. Reasons vary. Some say it's about holding the line. the need to preserve the institution's values and norms. Others talk about the importance of respecting the election result. If this is what America voted for, that's what I need to carry out, one colleague said. Many are simply reluctant to give up a stable, fulfilling job. Another colleague is close to retiring, so he's going to stick it out until then. I've just got to figure out how to keep my sanity. In my case, I just want to do the job. I get to advocate for the voiceless, speak truth to the powerful, and hold the unjust to account. Doing this on behalf of the United States is a privilege I'm reluctant to give up. I try to work out where my own red lines are, though. If I'm asked to do something that fundamentally transgresses my professional code, like declaring allegiance to the president over the Constitution, that would tip the scales in favor of leaving. When I started to investigate my options outside of government, it became clear that a transition wouldn't be simple. The administration is punishing law firms that hire people Trump sees as enemies. Nonprofits might be next. Prospective employers are wary of hiring attorneys involved in the January 6 prosecutions. As one colleague put it, we might as well be walking around with a scarlet J6 on our forehead. I ran the numbers and worked out that I can afford to be jobless for a little while if I cut back on spending. Our household has adopted austerity measures, fewer haircuts, no foreign holidays, more home cooking. Even being able to think about resigning is a privilege many of my colleagues don't have. Some are paying off student loans or caring for elderly parents. Sometimes I wonder how much my resignation would actually accomplish, aside from salving my conscience. The attorneys who resigned over the Adams case didn't prevent it from being dismissed. If anything, resignation served the president's goal of weeding out the disloyal. I lie awake at night going back and forth about what I should do and have to give myself a pep talk to pull out of it. I still have my job and mean to keep it, for the moment at least. I'm doing my best to sidestep the tripwires. In practice, that means going into incognito mode, as one colleague put it. I no longer say good morning to strangers. I'm not applying for promotions. I speak up less. Before, I never hesitated to push back if a superior took a position I didn't agree with. My job is to tell it to them straight. But more and more, I find myself biting my tongue. In order to hold on to my job, I'm having to do it less effectively. Chats with my colleagues sometimes rekindle my optimism. Yet we are cogs in the machine, but we're not automatons. We swap tips for surviving the new climate, emphasize that we are all playing on the same team, working to make the country stronger. Practice kindness, even when you disagree with someone. Cultivate allies. Adhere stubbornly to established norms and protocols. Freely discuss weaknesses in cases early and often. Trust that a judge will ultimately see through the bullshit. Above all else, stand for truth. One colleague told me that he was preparing for the possibility of being given a lawful but awful order. He'd have to carry it out, but would try to blunt the impact by throwing as many bureaucratic monkey wrenches into the wheel as possible. When justice so requires, as the legal phrase goes, we can drag our feet. And if that means getting fired, so be it. I'm spending more time than usual in dive bars. There are more farewell parties for colleagues these days. Some of these send-offs would have happened even if Kamala Harris had won the election. But most are for people who, one way or another, can't work under this administration. We toast their skill and dedication with shots of cheap whiskey, which flow freely. In quiet corners, people talk about where the department is headed. The word fuckery gets thrown about. But the visceral anger of the first few weeks seems to have given way to glum resignation. A colleague who once vowed he'd have to be dragged out of the department kicking and screaming has just taken a job in the private sector. I chatted to him at a recent party, and we reminisced about past victories. He told me he hoped to return one day and help restore the department to its former glory. It was a nice thought, at least. I leave these events wondering how long I will stay myself. 2 months in, the administration seems to have plucked all the low-hanging fruit. People who were widely known to be involved with the January 6 investigations. I expect they will come for the rest of us eventually. But for the moment, I seem to have the option of staying employed. I'm not sure that I should exercise it, though. For this administration, justice seems to be about winning, regardless of the facts. In recent weeks, federal judges have repeatedly torn into the positions my colleagues have taken in defense of administration policy, using fierce language like heck of a stretch and a sham. One judge said that government lawyers' interpretation of the law was so far-fetched as to defy rationality. Contempt for the truth is taking root in the department. If I stay on, I fear I'll be seen as complicit in all this. Maybe I am already. On a recent midday walk with my mentor, I asked him, "Are we even the good guys anymore?" He stopped and thought and then said, "Is your work still advancing justice?" Before I could reply, he started walking again. It seemed evasive to me, as if he didn't want to think seriously about whether we were in the wrong. Maybe I had lost perspective. Maybe I was the crank in the tinfoil hat crying fascism at everything. Or maybe he just wanted to stick his head in the sand. I find refuge in history. Recently I read The Power of the Powerless, an essay by Vaclav Havel, the Czech dissident who became his country's president after the fall of communism. He writes about how a regime built on lies demands that its people acquiesce to those lies. Daily acts of submission, no matter how seemingly insignificant, confirm the system, fulfill the system, make the system, are the system. Havel says that it's worth risking punishment for affirming the truth, because living in a lie alienates you from yourself. The other day I was looking over the empty spaces in my office where my January 6 memorabilia used to be. Havel's words made the memory of my cowardice sting. So I pulled the box out and returned each memento to its original spot. I may regret it, but in that moment I felt like the greater act of self-preservation wasn't hiding these keepsakes away. It was displaying them. This was first published in Economist 1843 magazine and used with permission. Some details have been changed to preserve the identity of the author. The views expressed are those of the author and not the department. Read a couple of the health and science articles. The gunk we're breathing in. Nearly half of Americans, around 156 million people, are living in areas with unhealthy air quality. That's the conclusion of the American Lung Association's latest State of the Air report, which looked at levels of ozone, the key component of smog, and particulate pollution between 2021 in 2023. The number of people affected jumped by 25 million from previous report, partly because of heat waves that produced extra ozone. Texas, for example, showed a sharp spike in ozone in 2023 after a long spell of scorching temperatures. Another major factor was wildfire smoke, which contains tiny bits of particulate matter that can penetrate people's lungs. In 2023, smoke from the fires in Canada wafted across a huge swath of the Northeast, and a study found that the smoke that year had undone about 25% of the progress in air quality made since the Clean Air Act was adopted in 1963. And it's not going to get better. While the Biden administration tightened rules on emissions from vehicles and power plants, the Trump administration is working to reverse those changes. Until we get a handle on the sources of emissions, the ALA's Catherine Pruitt tells NBCNews.com, we're going to suffer the consequences. Tippling chimps. Wild chimpanzees have been filmed for the first time getting drunk together. When a band of chimps in a nature preserve in Guinea-Bissau came upon breadfruit that had fermented, they gathered around to share it. Researchers recorded the behavior on 10 occasions, which suggests it is common. While breadfruit isn't very boozy, maxing out at 0.61% alcohol by volume, compared with 5% for beer, the total alcohol intake could be significant given that some 75% of a chimp's diet is fruit. Sharing is linked to social bonding, but also alcohol intake is linked to social bonding, at least in humans, study author Anna Boland of the University of Exeter tells the Washington Post. So it would be interesting to know whether the natural levels that chimpanzees are feeding on are having a social impact. Evolutionary biologists believe that humans' ability to metabolize alcohol stems from our primate ancestors, which also ate mostly fruits and would have needed to be able to digest even rotting ones. A color beyond our natural vision. Berkeley researchers say they have seen a glorious new color that no human had perceived before, reports USA Today. There's just one catch. You can only discern it while being blasted in the eye with a harmless laser. The hue, which the researchers call OLO, O-L-O, is a rich blue-green shade similar to a peacock green but more brilliant. Humans perceive colors when light falls on cone cells in the retina, called S, M, and L cones for short, medium and long wavelengths of light. Each cone is sensitive to different colors, from blue to green to red. In normal vision, light that stimulates an M cone always also stimulates one of the other cones. Before the study, the scientists used a precise laser to trigger only the M cone, pushing the realm of human vision beyond its natural limit and sending the brain a green color signal that wouldn't ordinarily exist. We didn't know what the brain would do with it, says co-author Ren Ng, who was also a participant. It was jaw-dropping. It's incredibly saturated. All five participants saw the new color, which appeared as a patch in their field of vision roughly twice the size of a full moon. The team said subjects could also be made to perceive other unprecedented colors beyond the natural human gamut. An imagery like brilliant red lines or rotating dots on an OLO background. They hope the technology will help colorblind people see normally or superhumanly. OLO is a starting point, said Ng, not an ending point. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. We'll read that article referred to in the cover drawing. Trump grading a consequential first 100 days in office. President Trump launched his second term in January with a promise to deliver a new golden age to Americans, said James Politi and Miles McCormick in the Financial Times. But as he marked his 100th day in office this week, a flurry of new polls showed that most voters view his shock-and-awe presidency as anything but glittering. Trump now has the lowest 100-day approval rating of any president, 41%, in at least seven decades, according to a CNN poll. He did even worse in a new Washington Post ABC News poll, which put him at 39%. The only reason Trump hasn't sunk to darker depths is because of the North Korean level of support he enjoys among Republicans, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. With everyone else, he's in free fall. Trump's numbers among independents have turned gruesome, routinely in the 30s, and in two surveys, one of them from Fox News, in the 20s. His support among Latinos, a crucial group that helped him deliver him the White House last November, has collapsed to 27%, according to the Pew Research Center. Trump's net approval on the economy, traditionally his strongest issue, is underwater by double digits. Only 34% like how he's handling tariffs, according to the Post. While he fares better on immigration, winning 47% approval in the New York Times survey, he's trending down there too. Ever the narcissist, Trump decried his approval numbers as fake and demanded the pollsters be investigated for election fraud. Excuse me. It didn't have to be this way, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Trump secured a popular vote plurality and a battleground state sweep in the November election and took office in January with an approval rating in the low 50s, higher than at any point in his first term. He could have moved cautiously to consolidate support and deliver the pre-COVID normalcy that voters desperately wanted. Instead, he ran with radicalism, signing a barrage of executive orders that stretched every known limit on presidential powers to the breaking point, filling his cabinet with incompetent MAGA talking heads and threatening international allies with invasion and crippling tariffs. Each time, Trump could have chosen moderation, such as boasting of reducing border crossings rather than a noisy, court-defying, and not terribly productive wave of immigrant deportations. He opted for extremist moves that frighten and repel people outside the MAGA movement. By far the biggest self-inflicted wound is Trump's tariff policy, said Rich Lowry in National Review. It's hard to think of another president who squandered positive momentum as quickly as Trump did on Liberation Day, when he slapped shocking and unsustainable import taxes on nearly every country. The trade war has since coalesced into a standoff with China, but the damage to Trump's reputation as a guardian of the economy was done, and he has no one else to blame, not Congress and not the deep state. He did it all with a couple of strokes of his pen. Voters elected Trump to control inflation and raise real incomes, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But tariffs do the opposite, because importers inevitably pass along higher cost to consumers. Unless Trump embarks on a major reset, the economic and foreign policy shocks he unleashed could sink his presidency. You can criticize Trump for living out his tariff man fantasies, said Niall Ferguson in the Free Press. But even his fiercest critics can't accuse him of overpromising and underdelivering. During his campaign, Trump told us exactly what he was going to do, and he has. From stripping left-leaning universities of federal funding, to downsizing the federal bureaucracy, to protecting children from gender transition procedures, and yes, to imposing beautiful tariffs. So far, Trump has issued nearly 200 executive orders, proclamations, and memorandums to achieve his aims. Not since the first year of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first term has an administration engaged in such frenetic activity. Trump's term has indeed been consequential, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic, but judged against Roosevelt's record, his first 100 days should be deemed a miserable failure. Trump hasn't signed any significant legislation into law, and his economic interventions have only slowed growth and sunk the markets. But because Trump's goals are so historically aberrant, traditional metrics of presidential achievement are of little use. What matters to Trump is that he has successfully forced many of his foes, including media owners, law firms, and universities, into compliance by threatening investigation, prosecution, and punitive defunding. With his immigration crackdown, he has acquired the ability to disappear people who may or may not have committed crimes. And with his generous pardons of allies and selective enforcement of the law, he has paved the way for self-enriching corruption and an extra-legal regime in which law prisoners bind only his enemies. Trump's first 100 days have put the U.S. on an unsustainable course with a weaponized illiberal state pitched against a smoldering political backlash. One of them will have to break. And time for a couple of the short notes. Anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. last year hit their highest level since the Anti-Defamation League began tracking the data in 1979, with at least 9,354 cases of assault, harassment, and vandalism recorded. That's up 5% since 2023 and 344% since 2019. Anti-Semitic incidents on college campuses were up 84% over 2023. In the first 3 months of the second term, President Trump mentioned former President Joe Biden, his family, or administration at least 580 times in public remarks or on social media. That's an average of 6 times a day. In contrast, Biden mentioned Trump 29 times in the first 100 days of his presidency. Aspiring members of a new MAGA-aligned club in Washington, D.C. are offering to pay double the $500,000 membership fee to get off the wait list. The executive branch is co-owned by Donald Trump Jr., GOP mega-donor Omid Malik, and other investors. Prospective members are screened for loyalty to President Trump. Just time for a quick quote. Emily Dickinson says, "Tell the truth, but tell it slant." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.